Hello and welcome to another episode of Damn Interesting Week. We are so glad you've decided to join us. My name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And this was a Damn Interesting Week. So let's get started with our first link.
First link. All right, Keanu, make some room on the good guy celeb bench because John Bon Jovi, as reported by My Modern Met, he bravely talked a woman down from the ledge of a Nashville bridge.
Nice. Mm.
This was on September 10th on the Siegenthaler Pedestrian Bridge in Nashville. And he happened to be there with his team because they were filming a music video on site for a song called The People's House. But the bridge remained open to the public during the shoot. So the video, and it's kind of amazing to see. I'm very wary about stuff like this, but it is at a distance and it is kind of very minor, but also really major in this person's life. What you can see is Bon Jovi and this unknown production assistant, they start to just slowly walk over, approach the woman in blue. They greet her with a gentle wave. She waves back and he just like super casually leans against the bridge railing. Like, hey, I'm just having a conversation with you.
Yeah. For the record, if someone's holding onto the rail, do you want to wave? Like, don't make them let go. What?
Yeah, you don't want to trigger their wave response, but she does wave back, I guess, with one of the hands that's not gripping on, and he just sort of leans against the railing. So we don't really know what the conversation was, but it doesn't take very long for the woman to be persuaded to come to safety. So you see the production assistant kind of like rubbing the woman's back. She turns around, agrees to step back over the railing. And then once she was safe, they just share a few more moments together on the bridge. Bon Jovi gives the woman a hug. And here's what I really love about this, too. Like, obviously, this video went viral, but out of respect for the individual involved, Bon Jovi has chosen not to discuss the incident with the media.
That's good.
But he's no stranger to this kind of behavior. For example, in 2019, he opened two restaurants where people in need can eat for free. Mm. He's even been known to wash dishes there. But yeah, kind of amazing. And again, if you or someone you know has suicidal thoughts, reach out for help or just, you know, call a friend, call a stranger.
That's got to be so surreal. Like, I mean, unless maybe she doesn't know who Bon Jovi is, he could be way before her time. But if you do know who he is, and you're already in a weird headspace to begin with, and you look up and he's standing there. Like, you got to think maybe you're hallucinating.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Do I have to be the jaded one here? Is it going to be me that has to say that maybe she was a staff member?
Oh, no. Out of respect for her privacy, he's like, please don't sue me. I work them really hard.
This is a good feel-good story.
I've also seen some TikToks where they try to say this part of the movie was actually real because somebody caught it with a cell phone, but it was just part of a movie. Mm-hmm. Was this part of his music video?
I mean, at this point, no, because he's gone viral for supposedly saving somebody.
Right. So
he's
now like, he has to bury
we got
to
change this.
Okay. New video, guys.
Wow. Pour one out for the PR team working overtime on this one, huh? Uh-huh. All right, next link.
Next link.
This article comes to us from CNN.com, titled, He bought a cruise ship on Craigslist and spent over $1 million restoring it. Then his dream sank.
Yeah, I was waiting for that third part. I was like, there's no way this ends well. It's not, and it opens today. It's like...
So, buying a historic cruise ship he found on Craigslist back in 2008 was undoubtedly a life-altering decision for Chris Wilson. The technology entrepreneur from Utah spent around 15 years painstakingly restoring the 293-foot vessel, which contains 85 cabins, a swimming pool, and a theater, and even moved on board with his long-term partner, Jin Lee. There's a photo of them, you know, in front of it. And yeah, it's literally a cruise ship, y'all. Like, it is a whole-ass cruise ship.
Wow. But it's in Utah.
I don't think it actually ends up in Utah,
yeah,
but
it's in the Great Salt Lake. Yeah. It's just going in circles.
Yeah. So Wilson says he poured his life savings into the Passion Project, and his ultimate goal was to transform the neglected ship into a museum, but things didn't quite go to plan. In October 2023, Wilson made the painful decision to sell the vessel, which began sinking around 7 months later. Now its future looks bleak, which, you know, thankfully, after you sell it, it starts sinking. I mean, otherwise...
Well, did he sell? It sounded like he made the decision to sell it and hadn't sold it yet. Because why would it be about him if he didn't still own it?
It's a little unclear. I mean, he owned it most of the time, but as we get further on, we'll see, like, did he sell it? It's kind of hard to say.
I'm sure his accountants are really trying to control the narrative.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I can tell you this is like the most literal story of sunk cost fallacy I've ever heard. So Wilson tells CNN Travel, "We absolutely loved our time with that ship. It selling was probably the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. Mm. It haunts me and I lose sleep over it. I'm not happy about it." So where did it all go wrong? Wilson's long-standing connection to the retired cruise ship began when he came across a sale listing on the Craigslist classified advertisement site and decided to investigate. He discovered that the vessel, originally named Wappen von Hamburg, was constructed by the Blom & Voss shipyard in 1955 and had been the first significant passenger line built by Germany after World War II. So once he took the ship on, Wilson arranged for it to be moved to the California river city of Rio Vista, where it stayed for a year, and renamed it to Aurora after spending his first night on board. He said, "I woke up to one of the most brilliant sunrises I had ever seen. I remember thinking that Aurora was a fitting name." And although he's unsure the exact amount he spent on maintaining the ship and moving it forward over the years, he estimates the figure to be well over $1 million. If only we also could not be sure of how much money we're spending.
Six figures, seven figures, who can say, you know?
Yeah. As long as it doesn't hit eight figures, I'm fine.
Right.
So he says, "We were making terrific progress with the Aurora. We had a successful YouTube channel. Everything was looking great." However, Wilson says he faced much resistance from locals who weren't thrilled about having such a huge decommissioned ship moored nearby. The fact that another large vessel, Canadian minesweeper HMCS Chaleur, sank in 2021 certainly didn't help matters. According to Wilson, he received a three-day notice to quit on several occasions, but the local authorities never followed through with an eviction.
What are they going to do?
Yeah, how are they going to get it out of there? Where are they going to take it?
Yeah. He goes on to explain that things came to a head when 1940s military tugboat Mazapeta, stationed next to the Aurora, also sank in January, creating a pollution issue.
All right.
This is the marina where ships go to die. Like, what is happening?
Yeah, I think the marina might be the issue. Like, just get the boat out, man.
Right.
So, although Wilson did consider moving the ship, he says he learned that the waterway would have likely needed $1 million worth of dredging for us to get out. So we were kind of stuck there, he says. While they were desperate to finish what they started, Lee says that the situation began to take a huge toll, and the couple felt that they had no other option but to move on to the next chapter. When an interested buyer showed up who seemed equally as passionate about saving the ship, they decided to sell it. Wilson stresses that he had every confidence that the unnamed individual was the right person to keep the Aurora going, and spent time talking through how to maintain the ship. When asked about the general condition of the ship at the time, Wilson says that while there were some holes when he first purchased it, they were patched professionally and he never had any problems afterwards. However, in May, the San Joaquin County Sheriff's Office announced that the Aurora was sinking. A statement posted on X, formerly known as Twitter, read, "It has been determined the ship has suffered a hole and is taking on water and is currently leaking diesel fuel and oil into the Delta waterway."
Yeah.
Yay. Yeah. The ship was refloated by contractors hired by a unified command, according to the U.S. Coast Guard, which confirmed that it had recently changed ownership. Over the last several weeks, response contractors, Global Diving and Salvage, and subcontractors successfully refloated the vessel and removed an estimated 21,675 gallons of oily water, 3,193 gallons of hazardous waste, and 525-yard bins of debris was removed from the vessel. Thankfully, there were no observations of oiled wildlife throughout the response. According to Connie Cochran, community relations officer for the city of Stockton, there was no clear ownership for the Aurora when the situation occurred, and the city is currently figuring out how to dispose of the vessel. Wilson, who maintains that he filed the change of ownership for the Aurora with the Coast Guard Vessel Documentation Center, says he was surprised when he learned that the ship had partially sunk. "I didn't see it sinking," he says. "We had it for 15 years and we had no problem with it." CNN has been unable to independently confirm the current registered owner of the ship.
Yeah, no, he didn't sell that. He made a shell company, showed a paper trail of transferred money so that he could not be held liable when it definitely sank because it was gonna.
So he adds, "I meticulously maintained that ship. I checked everything on it multiple times. It just saddens me like nothing else."
Mm-hmm.
He says there's only three historic liners left in the United States, and another one of them is about to see its fate as well, referring to retired ocean liner SS United States, which has been ordered to leave Philadelphia's Delaware River. So it's very sad to see such famous ships eventually dismantled, especially for no good reason.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe they're falling apart is a good reason.
Yeah. Dismantle them.
It costs more to maintain them. Yeah. They're not worth the historical relevance.
Polluting the lakes.
I mean, I'm guessing he had no way to get an insurance policy on a situation like this, right?
Probably not. I mean, who's going to insure a cruise ship from the 1950s, right? Like, Progressive? I don't know.
Flo is on top of that stuff, man. She'll do it.
Yeah. And the better thing to do with a ship like that is strip it of all of its toxic parts, sink it, make an artificial reef, have people dive to it, and it's a win-win.
Hey, but you can charge admission when you open it as a theme park.
You charge admission to the reef.
You can charge admission to the oil spill.
That's true.
The historic site where the Aurora Wappen von Hamburg spilled all her oil.
It's an interactive one. They give you a bottle of Dawn and they say, go clean a bird. It's fun.
Oh, gosh.
Oh. Next link.
Next link.
Okay. This comes from Science Alert. Scientists identify new blood group after a 50-year mystery.
Ooh. Oh.
So when a pregnant woman had her blood sampled back in 1972, doctors discovered it was mysteriously missing a surface molecule found on all other known red blood cells at the time, known as ANWJ. Do you all know your blood type?
I know that I'm A positive. I don't know if I have this ANWJ thing, but
I don't even know if I know my type. I feel like I should know.
I know, me too, but it's never something I've asked. I just thought I'd ask you guys if you knew first. It's just me that didn't feel like an adult.
No, I'm weird. Like, I know my husband's, I know my kids. I'm very strange about it.
You are prepper ready.
I guess. Uh-huh. That's true. In the apocalypse, I'll know, except I won't know who I can get it from. I won't be able to test anybody, so it won't do me any good. Anyway.
Right. Well, apparently humans have many different blood systems based on a wide variety of cell surface proteins and sugars that coat our blood cells. So our bodies use these antigen molecules as identification markers to separate cells from potentially harmful not selves. Most major blood groups were identified in the early 20th century. The others only impact a small number of people, like the ER blood system first described in 2022. This is also the case for the new blood group, which is why you probably don't have it. Previous researchers found that more than 99.9% of people have the ANWJ antigen that was missing from the 1972 patient's blood. This antigen lives on the myelin and the lymphocyte protein, leading the researchers to call the newly described system the MAL blood group. Not realizing, of course, that mal also means bad.
Right.
When someone has a mutated version of both copies of their mal genes, they end up with an ANWJ negative blood type, like the pregnant patient. What's more, researchers found that ANWJ isn't actually present in newborn babies, but appears soon after birth.
Huh.
Now that researchers have identified the genetic marker behind mal mutation, patients can be tested to see if their negative mal blood type is inherited or due to suppression, which could be a sign of another underlying medical problem. So either you're born with it and it's fine, or you're born with it and it's not fine.
Mm-hmm.
Here's my favorite part, and this is at the start of the Halloween season. This is a direct quote from the article. "The research was published in Blood."
Wait, I'm sure they mean a journal named Blood, right?
Oh, it's a journal named right. Blood. There's a link to it. Yeah. Next link is a short article.
Next link.
All right. Next up, we've got a fun little explainer from Half as Interesting, no relation, called The Board That Decides Every Place Name in the U.S.
Whoa.
And if we're being honest, the title should really be Every Place Name for the U.S., because not only does the U.S. Board on Geographic Names have jurisdiction over everything from creeks to cities to mountains, they also decide what Americans are going to call geographic features outside the U.S., and they don't necessarily care what the countries who actually own those landmarks call them.
Yeah.
Which is a little ironic because it's something they're a little sensitive to themselves, as they note in their official documentation, quote, "Perhaps the most common error is to refer to the U.S. Board on Geographic Names as the U.S. Board of Geographic Names." They're like, we can do it, but don't you dare. That being said, they do seem to take their job pretty seriously and not just slap names on things at random. In fact, the original purpose of the BGN was to try to remove some of the randomness that was occurring as Western territories were being added to the U.S. in the late 1800s. Because not only did you have situations where the town on one side of a river called it something completely different than the town on the other side, but even when they agreed, you had a massive variety of spellings popping up from people with varying degrees of literacy. So in 1890, President Benjamin Harrison said, we got to make this stuff official, and the BGN was born. Today, they have a total of 60 members who are mostly government employees in other departments who are just helping out part-time when the board officially meets once a month. They maintain a roster of over 2 million place names. And while you would think we've pretty much named everything by now, there are still new geographic features being discovered and mapped at the bottom of the ocean floor, as well as in outer space. Because you've got to know what that crater on the moon is called if you're going to coordinate a landing there, right?
I mean, if you have coordinates, that's okay. Yeah, okay.
They've also, in recent years, been kept quite busy renaming places that were originally given offensive names.
Yeah.
Of which there are still hundreds, and they're doing their best. But the process to name or rename something does involve a lot of paperwork because, you know, it's the federal government. But that's really the only instance where the BGM will step in and just start renaming things themselves. Usually, their job is to accept or reject applications from the general public. And the author walks us through the process by imagining there is a small mountain on his land that he wants to rename Mount Sam. So we start with an application that includes specific GPS coordinates and a description of the thing you want to name, why you want to name it that, and supporting letters from other people who live in the area who agree that it should be named Mount Sam, as well as an honest description of any local opposition to the name change. At that point, someone on the BGN creates a case brief that includes all the stuff you wrote, but also includes a thorough list of potential counterarguments. This could include anything from your suggested name is unreasonably long to there's another Mount Sam just a few miles away. Then that brief goes on the BGN's docket for their quarterly review list, along with every other proposal that came in during that time. And there's a screenshot here of some actual proposals that have come through recently, such as a person in Florida who wanted to rename something Vampire Lake because the overall vibe of the place was, quote, creepy, sinister, and evocative of supernatural swamp monsters. The staff member in the case brief, however, noted that the Florida State Names Authority opposed the change because naming any public area with the word vampire could potentially create some unwanted activity. Like, they think it's going to be a goth hangout? I don't know.
I mean, you do invite a certain vibe with a word like that, right?
For sure. So once the case brief has been released on the quarterly review list, the public has 2 months to comment, after which the committee members will discuss and debate the case at one of their monthly meetings, ultimately voting to approve, reject, or send it back to the original applicant for more information. And this is the point in the process where things can either get rubber stamped and be on the map within 3 working days, or potentially be stalled for years if there are actually people who feel strongly on both sides. One proposal currently in the system, for example, originated as far back as 2014 on behalf of members of the Lakota Nation who want to rename the town of Devil's Tower, Wyoming, and the associated Devil's Tower National Monument because they say it's a sacred location in their culture and the name Devil's is offensive. But, of course, there's some people who live there who think that's not a good enough reason, and they don't want to change it. So the application has been going back and forth ever since.
Right. Vampires, bad. Devils, fine.
Yeah,
fine.
Exactly. Listen, things are done differently in Wyoming. They're not as sensitive as Florida.
Yeah, I mean, the devil is real. Vampires are fictional.
Yeah, obviously.
Okay, fair point. Fair point.
And actually, the name Devil's Tower is also an illustration of one of the weirder rules that the BGN has about naming things, which is that you can never use apostrophes. It's not devil apostrophe S, it's just devil's plural tower. And honestly, that alone is enough reason to change it as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, that bugs me now. I did not know that.
Oh, yeah. And it's everywhere. Harper's Ferry does not have an apostrophe. None of them do. Except... over the years, precisely 5 locations have snuck through with their apostrophes intact because somebody didn't catch it and they just stamped it, including Martha's Vineyard and 4 other places you've never heard of. Like, they're all boring. They're like, but Martha's Vineyard gets an apostrophe and Harper's Ferry doesn't. And it's just very unfair. But aside from no apostrophes, some of the other rules the BGN tries to follow are under 28 characters long and not near to something with a similar name, like we said. They also forbid commercial or promotional names. And as is relevant in the hypothetical case of Mount Sam, they don't allow commemorative names for people unless that person has been dead for at least 5 years. Hmm. And even then, that person has to have had a specific important connection to that geographical location. Just owning it or living there is not enough. On the other hand, the BGN can be overridden and will fundamentally accept any name change if it is decreed by an act of Congress or is simply chosen by the Secretary of the Interior, who apparently has the constitutional authority to change any name anywhere for any reason.
Tuggy McTuggerson!
Exactly. She totally could.
Didn't realize there was a job in government I wanted.
Right, exactly. And it has actually been done at least once before. In 2015, Secretary Sally Jewell renamed Mount McKinley in Alaska to its more traditional Koyukon native name, Denali.
I remember that. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And actually, that was a weird thing where, like, people were fighting about this for decades, and they renamed Denali National Park. And they were like, see, it's a compromise, because there were a bunch of people in Ohio where McKinley was from who were like, no, you have to honor this guy. And people were rightly pointing out he never even went to Alaska. He never saw, like, this. It was totally random that his name got slapped on it in the first place. But that means that the current Secretary of the Interior, Deb Haaland, could decide to just name something Mount Sam. And it wouldn't even have to be a mountain. She could name the Pacific Ocean Mount Sam if she wanted to.
Yeah, it's like White Settlement, Texas. It does what it says on the can.
Yeah, well, they're changing that one, I assure you. Next link?
Next link!
Good news, everyone. New Atlas is reporting that a new golden lettuce has been genetically engineered to pack 30 times more vitamins.
Huh. I bet it tastes great.
Well, you know, it's good news for those of us who don't eat as many fruit and veggies as we know we should. And yeah, okay, it's not the most exciting vegetable, but it does show up in a lot of foods, whether it's padding for a sandwich, it's in a wrap, a salad, other meals. So a team from the Research Institute for Plant Molecular and Cellular Biology, they've genetically engineered the humble lettuce to boost the levels of the antioxidant beta-carotene. That's what your body uses to make vitamin A and is important for healthy vision, immune function, cell growth. It's even thought to be protective against Alzheimer's, heart disease, and some types of cancer.
Hmm.
You probably are most familiar with beta-carotene in carrots, pumpkins, sweet potatoes, all those really rich orange foods, right?
Mm.
However, when it's really concentrated and it's a fresh leaf, it does have that more orangey color, but then it just sort of like fades into this yellow type of thing. It's really pretty, but also my brain's like, don't eat it, but I should, right? Because the levels of beta-carotene in the golden lettuce leaves were up to 30 times higher than those of regular lettuce. And they're more bioaccessible, which means that our digestive systems can actually extract them more easily from the food.
Right. It is better than having a salad and swallowing a pill.
Oh, gosh. Just make me do one, right? Now, increasing the levels was not a completely straightforward effort, if you thought it was. Part of this is because beta-carotene is normally produced in a plant's chloroplast. Those are the cellular structures that perform photosynthesis. But if you jam too much in there, it reduces the plant's ability to gain energy from sunlight. So the team found a way to move the antioxidant into different parts of the plant cells. According to lead author of the study, Manuel Rodriguez Concepcion, our work has successfully produced and accumulated beta-carotene in cellular compartments where it is not normally found by combining biotechnological techniques and treatments with high light intensity.
What's the trade-off they're not telling us about?
Well, we don't know yet.
We'll find out after about a million Spaniards eat some, and then we'll get the results.
Well, and they do say high light intensity. And so the growing conditions, you know, this probably does need to be a hydroponic setup where you have a lot of control over the lights. But we do already have genetically enhanced foods that we currently enjoy, or some people do. For example, nutritious radishes. We've got peas. Have you ever seen those purple tomatoes? Those started to circulate into supermarkets, but those are genetically enhanced and are packed with, I think, more whatever the purple stuff is in vegetables.
Right. That's right next to the Sunny D, the purple stuff.
Yeah, the purple stuff. Exactly. You'll love it. It's good for you.
And genetically enhanced, are we using that? Because GMO is a bad word.
Probably.
They've been scienced up, my friends. And since we all eat much science food, you should be celebrating the fact that we're sciencing up our veggies.
Right. At least this is science healthy and not science. How long can this stay on the shelf?
Right. It's not like Aaron Paul's Lunchable effort. Like, this is stuff you really ought to be eating. Okay. Right. Next link.
Next link.
A short one here from BBC.com's titled French Dig Team Finds Archaeologist's 200-year-old note.
That's pretty meta.
It's level two of archaeology.
Yeah. So a team of student volunteers on an archaeological dig in northern France has had a surprise communication from the past. They uncovered an earthenware pot containing a small glass flask. Team leader Guillaume Blondel, who heads the archaeological service for the town of Eu, says it was the kind of vial that women used to wear around their necks containing smelling salts. Inside the bottle was a message on paper, which read as follows. PJ Ferret, a native of Dieppe, member of various intellectual societies, carried out excavations here in January 1825. Huh. He continues his investigations in this vast area known as the City of Limes or Caesar's Camp. Ferret was a local notable, and municipal records confirm that he conducted a first dig at the site 200 years ago. Mr. Blondel says it was an absolutely magic moment. Most archaeologists prefer to think that there won't be anyone coming after them because they've done all the work. In the weeks since the dig began, several artifacts dating from the Gaulish period, mostly pieces of pottery from around 2,000 years ago, have been uncovered. And that's about it. Just a little time capsule piece of history, but there are photos in the article of this very old bottle. And unveiled, of course, is the most beautiful cursive French. Very neat, right. Not lined paper, but it's all straight on a line. I could never.
Right.
So much more eloquent than we would be now, which would just be like, Brad was here.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
It's so weird that he reburied it. Like, if he dug this thing up, I guess he was like, well, this artifact's not important, so I'll just...
No, he left it for the next archaeologist to do their level 3 finding of it when they get around to digging it back up.
He's geocaching.
Right. I am way too lazy to dig up the rest, so I'll just put this here now, and they'll dig it up later.
Yeah, I'll get partial credit.
Yeah, there you go.
Next link.
Next link.
This comes from Phys.org. New evidence suggests allergies were partly to blame for the demise of woolly mammoths.
Aww.
And I thought my allergies were bad.
Poor little sneezing mammoths.
Yep. A team of chemists and zoologists from Israel, Italy, and Russia have found evidence suggesting that part of the reason woolly mammoths went extinct was the onset of allergies that made it difficult for them to find mates. In their paper published in the journal Earth, History, and Biodiversity, the group describes how they found antibodies and allergens in tissue samples of frozen mammoths that suggest the large animals may have had difficulty in finding their mates due to loss of smell.
Oh, I thought it was like they're allergic to their mates. I was like, yeah, that would cause a problem.
I thought it was because they just had really leaky snouts and like all of their mates were like, oh, no way. Yeah. Get away.
Too gross. Yeah. Prior research has shown that woolly mammoths once lived in parts of North America, Asia, and northern parts of Europe. They went extinct approximately 4,000 years ago. Studies looking into their demise suggest it was likely a combination of climate change and hunting by humans. And if we zoom out on this, it's still climate change.
Right.
The researchers note that the sense of smell is very important to modern elephants. Without it, elephants wouldn't find food, water, or potential mates. To learn more about the ancient creatures, the research team obtained and studied multiple tissue samples from frozen mammoths found in Siberia. They found evidence of antibodies that had been deployed to fight off infections. They also found organic compounds consistent with pollen that would have been mixed with the air the mammoths were breathing. And back to the climate change, the research team also notes that the extinction of woolly mammoths came during the time when the planet was growing warmer, allowing plants to grow in places that they would not have grown before. So it seems Snuffleupagus was actually historically accurate.
Oh, he was just under that Benadryl haze the whole time.
Exactly. That's why his eyes were droopy. Oh.
He's like, right? He's so sad and tired all the time.
Uh-huh. It's the histamines.
They had it right.
All right. Well, that is all we have time for today. We're so glad you've joined us. Some of the articles we did not have time to get to today include exposing the flaw in our phone system, could we turn the sun into a gigantic telescope, and the dangerous fantasy of cybernetic cops. So all that and more, plus everything we talked about today, can be found on DamnInteresting.com. If you like our podcast and want to support us, you can do so at patreon.com/DamnInteristingWeek. In the meantime, my name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And we hope you have a damn interesting week. Bye-bye.